start of a conversation. And the mandate that Maite gave me is so vague that we're going to, well, it was supposed to be about quantum gravity and string, right? Both of them are little subjects,
yeah.
Right?
I know that. So, usually you like.
So I don't know. So let's have, I want to have a conversation about quantum gravity, loop, and strings, let's say, and then see how it goes. But, you know, you're supposed to steer me a little bit in the direction you'd like to go. Maybe what I'm thinking of is that, you know, at the stage you're in, if you hear the word quantum gravity, you may be, I would be at your place, very confused, because what you may see in the world is a sense of people having different techniques. Could be people doing loops, people doing string, people doing ADS CFT, causal sets, non-commutative geometry, and then pretending that quantum gravity is whatever it is that their tool allow them to answer the question to, right? And I don't know if this is the impression you have, but it looks very scattered and everybody has very specific, very different tools, and they kind of do different things. So what is the common ground and what is the overlap? Or I don't know if that's a question that you had. No? Or is that something that you're, you know, I would be. So I'd like to try to say a few things, maybe. So quantum gravity, you know, what is it? What is it supposed to be? So when I started my PhD, I was at the same stage, it was 1990, okay. That's not yesterday, but, you know, the internet was just, it was the first year I started my PhD. First day was the invention of the email, browser, and internet. I got an email, I got a browser, I had nobody to send my email to. there was only one site to browse, which was the one created at CERN to see the APTH paper, where there was one string theory paper. And then that was kind of it. But so that time. At that time, you know, I was told quantum gravity, we're done. It's solved, right? It's completely solved, and the theory that solved it is called string theory. So I, you know, as a PhD student, I wanted to catch up, and I studied the Green-Schwarz-Witten, I read it. And it left me with, you know, wonderful feeling and learning lots of things, but for some reason I could never really understand why people were claiming it was solved. So why did people claim that string theory at that time, 1990, the theory was done, like it was over, right? Quantum gravity was solved. It's essentially that it depends what problem you want to call quantum gravity. So at that time, the issue is that what string theory solved at that time is the possibility to compute to any loop order graviton scattering correction. So if you believe that quantum gravity equal all loop computation for graviton scattering, then they were right. You know, the theory was solved. That's why people were saying that. Now at the same time. Around the same year, I went to a wonderful school. It was in Les Ouches. It was still a time where all these approaches were treated as one, were treated organically. And in Les Ouches, there was a very beautiful school, which was organized by Julia, where we had a course. I had a course on loops. Azteca was there. I had a course on string theory. I had a course on non-commutative geometry by Anna Cohn. I had the first course ever by Toft on holography. Okay, everybody was talking about bits and black hole, and everybody was telling me this guy is done. He's crazy. We don't know what he's talking about. He did something great when he was 19 years old, but then, you know, don't listen to him. And then there were, so essentially these are going to be these are the four dominant themes. And they were something about matrix model, if you want, discrete geometry. But. And I think even today, the field of quantum gravity in terms of the tool that people use are really architecture around these four themes, I would say. But what I want to go a bit beyond and say, instead of focusing on the tool we have, is trying to understand why we have such a different perspective, and what is it that, what is the question that we're trying to address, right? So loop, I would say holography. So the one that has evolved the most is the concept of holography, and it's I would say non-commutative geometry, you know, would be the version of quantum gravity designed by mathematicians. What if a mathematician tried to do, you know, there's a physical project of quantum gravity, which is you want to create a new realm for quantum geometry, but there's a corresponding mathematical project, which is undergoing and unfinished. So if you're a mathematician, it's very important. What is the project? The project is that in mathematics, there's two completely different fields. You know, it's called algebra and geometry, and you could be the best algebraist in the world and know absolutely nothing about geometry, and vice versa. I remember being at a conference when I was a PhD. I worked on topological theory, and I met one of the students of Kirby who was able to knot 4D manifold out of two-handle regluing. I mean, and he was very, he could do that in his head, and I can promise you, this is pretty complex, the geometry of 4D topological manifold. He could not multiply a 2x2 matrix. He was top-notch, okay? So he was the top-notch geometer in his world. He didn't know what the 2x2 matrix multiplication was, okay? So algebra and geometry, left brain, right brain are different. Quantum gravity is inventing the type of mathematics that fuse them in one language, okay? So that's kind of an attempt here. And then it's a string theory. Okay, so to go back, okay, so I want to maybe talk about these four things. The one I'm going to talk maybe the less about is holography, but I'm going to focus on the two extreme here. So if for some people that was it, quantum gravity was solved, we were done, you know, it was checked. But some people were really not happy about that, and for them it was not solved. So why? What do they mean by that? So you know, there was another picture about what quantum gravity should be. It's from the people that were. What you have to appreciate is that there are really two cultures at play here. In the same way that in mathematics there's algebra and geometry, in physics there has been two opposite cultures that have survived for 3,000 years since the invention of science without having to mix. One is about it's about a central question of physics, which is what is the most fundamental object that a physicist should care about? What is it that builds up everything else? Well, that's a big, good question of physicists. And there's two versions of that. There is the version that everything is an atom, right? Everything is a single bit, and you put it together. And if you put simple object together, you get a complicated object, okay? And that's the culture of particle physics. And that's the culture of string theory, okay? So everything comes from the fundamental object, and you build the biggest object complicated. The other culture, which is totally opposite, is the culture of, let's say, Newton and Einstein, and that the most fundamental object in the universe is the universe itself. Because it's the shape of the universe that determines the symmetries, the symmetry that determines what you mean by a particle, so a representation of the Poincaré group, and therefore excitations organize themselves in terms of the structure of the substrate. So the most fundamental things in the universe is the bigger thing. And you can understand there's a clash, because on one side, you have physicists that say the most fundamental thing is the smallest object. On the other side, you have the people that say, no, the most fundamental thing is the biggest object, right? So quantum gravity, you sit in the middle, and you have to choose your camp in some sense, or I think if you're a modern one, you have to reconcile your view. But I'm extremizing the picture, but if you think about what you have learned in physics, you have learned completely philosophically opposite type of hypothesis and culture that a good theoretical physicist just ignore, you know. But quantum gravity is forcing you to be conceptually consistent. You have to resolve that question. What is the most fundamental object in the universe? The smallest or the biggest? You can't have, I mean, I want to say both, but in order to say both, you have to kind of work a little bit harder. Do you appreciate this is for me why quantum gravity is so deep and difficult? So now, if you say, if you claim that this is not a problem, and you know very well what is the fundamental object, then you fall into, so I would say, you know, loops, to be fair, it's the camp of relativists. Okay, that says the what matters is really geometry, and string theory is the camp of atomistic. What matters is the problem. So clearly, because there are these two extremes, finding common ground and common question is very hard. Is there questions at that stage, or is it just too vague or too general? Okay, so. So what is the point of view of a geometer? A geometer says, well, what I need to study is geometry. So a relativist, you know, so this is the camp of relativist. Okay. And today what you're and this is the point of view of the atomist, if you want. And what you're witnessing today is somehow, you know, more and more attempts to have the two together, right? And that's, you're coming at a special moment, and I think an exciting moment, which is the moment where people study both together. So for a relativist, what is, you know, the fundamental object is geometry. The geometry is the sets of points, if you want. Okay, on the geometry, you need a notion of motion, which is called a differentiable structure. You need to know to move from one point to another. There's something that links the points. Then you need a metric or a notion of distance, and then you need a notion of transport. Okay, distance, transport. And the history of relativity is essentially that initially, you know, the notion of initially all these geometrical notion were somehow God-given, eternal, non-dynamical, and kind of the same. And Euclidean geometry is a something where essentially the notion of point, you know, is a Cartesian point, so it's tied up with what you think about the metric. And the notion of motion, there's no difference between transport and motion. Object move in the same way you transport. You move from point to point. Now, in curved geometry, what happened is that you know, you differentiate the notion of transport from motion. The metric is no longer flat, and then this transport is how you move objects, whereas motion is how you move within the manifold among points. And then and relativity is essentially finding the laws that determines dynamically these different notions. Okay, one notion that has still stayed completely classical, if you want, and God-given, is the notion of what is the sets of points and its differentiable structure. This is still today kinematical, and I don't know if, and in some sense, for me, quantum gravity is understanding in what sense that structure is going to be affected by quantum mechanics. So for me, maybe I'm going to say, what is quantum gravity? Quantum gravity is trying to answer the question, what is the point? that's what quantum gravity is about. What does replace, it's a joke, but it's a serious joke, what does replace the geometrical structure? Why is it important? Because the point is what distinguishes, you know, allows us to have a notion of scale. And the notion of scale is what allows us to differentiate, you know, bacteria from galaxy and separate physical phenomena. It's what allows us to define the notion of observer. It's what allows us to define the notion of interaction. This is what allows us to define the notion of fundamental probes. Okay? So everything that you have learned intuitively and necessarily rely on a collective sets of beliefs of what is the fundamental structure that you're not going to touch on, and this is the point, right? Within chapter minus one or zero of every of your textbooks, there's an hypothesis about what's the sets of points your fields are living in or excitations are living in. Okay, so quantum gravity is about trying to kind of understand what this is about. What are the universal things we know is that whatever quantum gravity, in some sense, it has to be a form of unification of some sorts, because there's really, when you turn on h bar and g, there's really two new fundamental constants that you have, which are dimensionful, which is the Planck mass and the Planck length. Okay, So the Planck mass and the Planck length are let me put it differently. So this one, the product of them is essentially h bar. So we know this one is quantum. But now the ratio of them, so mp over lp, this is a tension, right? This is a unit of energy per length. So this is a gravitational tension, if you want, and this is 1 over g. Okay? So in a theory of quantum gravity, you have a Planck length and a Planck mass. And if you believe the principle of relativity, so let's say here I'm going to make an hypothesis that quantum gravity is not about breaking and going back. It's a form of unification of higher order, which means that essentially the challenge you're facing. So what is the point? Whatever the point is, it has to be such that it respects the relativity principle. Together with a fundamental length scale. Okay, so whatever is this new concept of geometry, in some way, it should have a built-in notion of fundamental length, right? And this built-in notion of fundamental length should be built in somehow the fabric of what the geometry is. But it should not be. I emphasize the relativity because if I break relativity principle, it's very easy to have a fundamental length scale. It's called condensed matter physics. Right? In condensed matter physics, you have an atomic system, and then you have a fundamental crystal length, and so having a fundamental length scale, and then you have a whole wealth of very interesting quantum phenomena. So I'm not saying that we should dismiss condensed matter, because what we learned from condensed matter is that once you have quantum mechanics and a fundamental length scale, okay, you don't have relativity, then there's all sorts of quantum phases that you cannot even describe classical mechanics, right? The superfluidity, superconductivity, all effects. And there's all form of geometry of the vacua, which are extremely complex, extremely beautiful. That in some sense, if you were trying to talk about it in a classical manner, you would just fail miserably. It's not that you would fail; you wouldn't even enter the mental space of talking about it. So I think condensed matter is a good understanding that what's different in quantum condensed matter? The presence of a length scale does two important things. One thing is that in the classical world, what we mean by the vacua is unique. You empty the room and that's it, and it stays, right? Whereas in condensed matter, there's a richness of vacua. They're like vacua which looks like an empty room, okay? And this is the vacua where you have particles and quasi-particles. But there are vacua which kind of back-react and dress the particle. This is like Fermi liquid type of vacua. And then you have other condensed phased vacua, which completely change where it's absolutely clear it's not an empty vacua, or the notion of emptiness belongs to some form of other universe. Okay, that's phenomena one. Like the vacua, I'm trying to equate mentally M, the point, with the vacua of condensed matter, is very rich. It's a complicated object. And the second thing which happens in condensed matter is what I call relative locality. The fact that the localizations of excitation depends on the energy of the probe you're using. So you can have a quantum material, and there's a beautiful experiment about that where if you look and you ask where is the electron localized? And for that you use a tunneling microscope. Okay, but the tunneling microscope depends on a voltage you use to measure the. Essentially, what you do is you measure the wave function, you take a slice at a given energy, and you see where it peaks. And depending on the energy you probe, you find where at low energy, you find that, things are localized at the crystal lattice. So this is what you would expect. At very high energy, you find it's localized at the crystal effect. Very low energy, you find it's completely localized. It's translation invariance. You don't really see the lattice. You average over it, and it's a continuum. And in between, you see structure like called Friedel oscillations and other meta structures, which are completely different, which tells you that the electron is localized on a scale which is intermediate between the UV and the infrared cutoff. So you know, the notion of, so these are the two things in quantum. In quantum. So we can learn from that, and I think we haven't yet learned, particle physics hasn't yet entered the phase where it can exhibit the richness of quantum vacua that condensed matter has. So quantum gravity is a little bit about that, but condensed matter breaks relativity. So, you know, so lots of people are, I mean, when people talk about emergence, I think holography and emergence are two terms which are used a little bit too much in my taste, because at some point it means different things for different people. But I mean, on a broad scale, when people talk about emergence, they say, well, I don't care about relativity, I'm going to break it, maybe it's like condensed matter, and then I can have a theory of quantum gravity which breaks that. And in some sense, the fundamental challenge of loop is a little bit this one. The fundamental challenge of loop is that it proposes a very specific and very beautiful and natural notion of quantum geometry, but it's not clear in what sense this notion of quantum geometry respects the relativity principle. And every modern attempt to understand that, it's not clear in what sense this geometry respects the fundamental symmetry of gravity. Okay, so what is the fundamental symmetry of gravity? Any question there? So when I say relativity, what is the fundamental? I mean, in a classical context, the geometry is the diffeomorphism invariance, right? And I think you have seen that this means when you formulated that like a parametrization invariance of your space and time points, and you have seen with Maite that essentially it has strong consequence that you have to write your physical equations as constraints equation, like the Hamiltonian and the diffeomorphism vanishes on shell. Now, and so the fundamental challenge is, okay, the problem of formulating it like that is that when I say diffeo invariance, I already refer to a concept of a classical manifold. So I'm kind of screwed in some sense, because, you know, clearly what I'm going to try to find, what is the point, has to have with itself the equivalent notion of what I mean by diffeo invariance. But well, you see the... I'm going to have to do a little bit of bootstrap. And this is where I think it's just because I have to do this fundamental bootstrap that there's still some validity for me into these models. I don't think any of this model is really the fundamental one, but you know, it's good to kind of you have to start somewhere. It's good to have a good model that works consistently, that gives you a hint on what is the proper way to bootstrap. In the same way, if you have studied inventions of quantum mechanics, there's lots of bootstrapping into understanding properly. The way people did, it was Max Born that first did it, just before Heisenberg. And what Max Born did is that he really understood very well what is the proper process of perturbation theory in Hamiltonian formulation. So he had the right kind of tool, bootstrap, semi-classical picture, that led him to the right. And then once you bootstrap yourself, you just have to let go of the previous picture and go. So all these models, in my view, they're just tools that we have today to try to bootstrap ourselves onto this question. So what is the sets of points? And essentially, it's the same thing. Diffeo invariance is about what do you mean by motion, which is same thing as what do you mean by points. So on that point, we have a new picture about diffeo invariance. A new way to look at diffeo invariance is to say, what does really diffeo invariance mean? Suppose I look at a region here with a boundary S. And I demand, well, I want to know where are stuff in that region. And how would I measure that? Well, for that, I would say, well, I'd like to be able to know where the energy is located, right? And essentially, diffeo invariance tells you that if you compute the energy of such a system, usually there will be a bulk energy and then a boundary energy. So in any other system in gravity, what do we do? That guy scale like the volume, that guy scale like the area. For big volume, you neglect that, and everything is the bulk. And then we study the bulk, okay? Gravity, and then same thing for momenta, right? You have the momenta of R, and you would have the momenta of the boundary. And usually we don't talk about that guy because everything is kind of contained there. Now, gravity tells you that what is the energy of the bulk? Well, it's zero. what is the momentum of the bulk? It's zero. So in any given region, that's holography. It does not, I mean, you know, historically it was kind of a process and turned into ADS-CFT, but what I'm saying is that this is why, you know, there's something much more general about it that has nothing to do with ADS-CFT. It has to do with the fundamental geometry of quantum gravity. So one way to understand diffeomorphism invariance is this ability for a theory to project itself on its corners, okay? And that's really puzzling, because the way we learn physics is that, you know, things happen here in the bulk, not in the boundary of that room. Okay, so holography is a very powerful concept that we're still learning to understand. And I think if you just try to understand it a little bit more than within the small restricted context of ADS-CFT, here what I'm talking about is what I call local holography, okay, which you could study a little bit in ADS-CFT, pretending that there's a preferred boundary at infinity. But deeply, this is what it is about. It's about another fundamental expression of the symmetry of the system, which, and as much as this one, I don't really know how to quantize, this one, you know, there's just more interesting ways in understanding it. Okay, so holography is really a new concept that can branch out in many, many different ways.
Why did you say the energy in the bulk was zero again?
Because the constraints. The constraints tells me that the Hamiltonian vanished. The Hamiltonian density. Gravity is a weird, right? If you look at the, so if you look at, okay, maybe if you look at the constraints, if I write the full Hamiltonian constraints, you can always split it, let's say, into a gravitational part that people today call a soft part, and then a matter part that people call hard. Okay? So to use the language of, there's a new field today, which is the field of soft physics, asymptotic fields, and et cetera. And it's about these things. So the full constraint is soft and hard. What does it mean? When you say it's zero, is that, of course, if I could cleanly separate what I call matter from what I call geometry, and then I can call the energy of the matter, you know, this is when you call about energy. What happens in gravity is that anytime I take any form of energy and I shake it, space-time react in such a way to compensate exactly the energy I put in, so that the total energy vanishes all the time, locally. The only thing you can measure is, you know, whatever crosses that boundary. So locally, the total energy vanishes. Now, if you believe that because you have a particular a background structure that you can make a split, okay, then you can decide to cut in half that thing and call that side the energy, right? The problem, so which is most likely what people do when they talk about energy, but often they don't tell you what split they use. They either assume it's self-evident, and it's kind of it's part of this implied thing. So the problem with the split is somehow it has to do with relativity. You can do a split, but it's very observer dependent or very arbitrary. It depends maybe on your choice of foliation. Depends on your preferred scarf. It depends on your whatever is your mental background. So I'm just trying to be. You could say, you know, if people are honest with you, they say there's a notion of energy. It means you should ask them, okay, what's your split? What do you mean? Which half do you put on the left, and which half do you decide to ignore? Okay, this balancing is it's very strange, but it is exactly what space-time is about. It's there to absorb, you know, anytime you punch it, punch back exactly to compensate what you're doing. It's very weird, okay? That's why holography is weird, but, okay? And then when I say zero, well, it's really that this is a boundary current, right? So, you know, usually if you take infinity, that guy goes to zero, but if there's a finite boundary, okay, if you do the calculation right, I'm not sure not that you did it wrong, but I don't think you went to that level of detail to look at the fact that if you really study that thing, then it's clear that if the bulk energy vanishes, you should better worry about the things you usually neglect, which is the boundary. Okay, so holography is kind of a much more elaboration on that, but essentially says, well, if you know what is energy, what is momentum, what is charge, and all of it can be determined completely from the point of view of the gravity, maybe you know everything. Maybe not, but maybe, right? This is this kind of a Okay, and maybe, in fact, you can just sit on the boundary and reformulate everything in terms of the measurement of physical quantity from the point of view of the boundary. Does that make sense? So from that point of view, it's a very holography follows naturally from relativity. Okay? I mean, what I'm saying is true for any gauge system, in fact, right? Where I use the charges as the type of probe. What's specific about gravity? So it would be true for electrodynamics. You know, the total charge of any system, if you add up the soft charge and the hard charge, they vanish in the bulk. It's all. You know, you compute the charge by an integral at the boundary. This is the only way you can have access to the charge of a system. The one thing that gravity is different. Why is gravity? So why are we talking? Because I could have talked about holography or soft modes in the context of QED, and in fact today people do. What's different today is essentially what's different in gravity is the fact that the energy it's causality, right? So time flows only upward or you know in the future, which is essentially the same thing as saying that the energy is positive, and because the energy is positive. Essentially, it means no screening. Okay? So, I mean, what am I saying? If there's a charge that wiggles in the center of the sun, it's going to be surrounded by lots of negative charge. And I'm here. I cannot see it. It's screened. It's phenomenally screened. If a mass wiggles at the center of the sun and I have a perfectly clear gravitational detector, I can see it. I can see everything. This is why gravitational wave astronomy is so important, because if you use gravitational wave, the universe is entirely transparent to it. There is no screening. You can see ultimately everything, okay? In principle, of course, in practice that's hard. But gravity is a form of light that admits no screening, and that's why the era we're entering is completely radically different from the previous era of electromagnetic vision. It's going to take a few centuries or millennium to get there, but we will eventually. If we survive, you know, other challenges. So far I was talking about, I was talking about why people were not happy with that. Clearly, nowhere what I say involved loop computation of graviton scattering. And at that moment where String had, there was no notion of, and I'm sure you were there in the course, I'm sure that the type of geometry that people explain to you the standard string theory is the usual type of geometry, right? It's the usual space-time. Right? There's nothing special about it. And then you do perturbation around usual space, and there's no built-in length scale. It's the usual relativity principle. So clearly, string theory was pretending to have a solved quantum gravity, but it never included this fundamental length scale into the fabric of space-time. And it never really changed what the point is, right? It never really told you what the point is. It kind of assumed that the point is the same point as the point of phi theory or effective phi theory. Okay, but today I think it's different. So I think today we have learned that string theory has something to say about quantum gravity. So So what I mean by quantum gravity is really that. It could be, you know, you might be inventing a new one. Anything that tells me what is the point? So what is string theory about? What's interesting about string theory, as I say, is it's that it's an atomistic theory. Okay? And it starts from a very different point of view. So the point of view is not that space-time is fundamental. It's that the fundamental probes are fundamental. You know, there's a famous philosopher, Heidegger, that wrote a book called "What Is a Thing." Okay, and physics. In fact, this book should have been written by a physicist. This is really the role of a theoretical physicist to understand what is a thing. And relativity says the thing is the universe, and string theory has a different take. And for that point of view, it should be credited by people thinking about gravity. No, the thing is the fundamental probe. Okay, so in particle physics, you know, the fundamental probe is point-like, particle. Okay, and you could say, what is space-time from the point of view of a point like particle? Well, space-time, I mean, you could argue, and in fact, you know, I've written paper about that, where I argue convincingly that, in fact, let's assume that there's no space-time. All I have is a collection of probes, which are relativistic in the sense that they satisfy the relativity principle, and they interact in some manner. They have quantum interaction where they can, you know, decay and nucleate. So there's a structure of the point of interaction. And then if you study the structure of interaction, it's clear that what you call space-time is somehow the property of this interaction. Space-time is a specific quantum number associated with how things interact, and then you call that things x. And then if you have enough x and you classicalize, you can create space-time. If you understand how things move, you know, you can reconstruct the geometry. So there's a point to be made that, in fact, space-time is a construct of your mind. It doesn't exist. The only thing that exists in the universe are processes, quantum processes, bits that interact with each other. And then it's this network of interaction that we conveniently, you know, mathematize and call space-time. And then we took this, as usual, theoretical physicists have a tendency to take their fantasy for reality, and we take mathematics for physics. Mathematics is not physics. This mistake has been made over and over and over again. You know, we invent mathematics because it's efficient, but mathematics is not physics. And any time we made a new discovery, like, you know, the most radical was Heisenberg uncertainty principle, you know, trajectory is mathematics, physics is processes. And Heisenberg understood that, that trajectories are not physics. And the challenge was to understand, well, what happened is the bubble chamber. Anyway, I'm not going to, but this is, you know, if you're a theoretical physicist and you want to address these fundamental questions, you have to be, I think there's, you know, I'm a mathematician, but you have to be very clear. Am I doing mathematics or am I doing physics? It's not the same thing, right? And mathematics, okay, you can, you know, but don't take your mathematics for reality, okay? And this is a mistake people have done over and over and over again. Anyway, so there you could argue that the space-time just doesn't exist. All that exists is us. It's a collection of agents interacting with each other. Okay? And in fact, if you take this at the onset, I know this is not how string theory is presented, but if you read the early paper, this is really what's so radical about string theory. String theory, the version I'm talking about was invented by Dan Friedan. It's really about that. This is really about the true emergence of space-time, saying that you know, I have a quantum objects that interact, and I'm trying to reconstruct the space-time from it. Okay. So, what do string theory? So what is so radical about string theory? So if you start from points like particle, which are relativistic, you can consistently. In some sense, point-like particle, what's interesting if you think about point-like particle is that they exist in momentum space, right? The thing, the charge which are conserved for isolated particle is momentum space. And the way you reconstruct position space is very complicated. If you are in particle physicist, you formulate everything in momentum space. Space-time is a very complex object from the point of view of momentum space. You have to derive it from a set of, you know, collections of processes. Okay, and essentially, X, you know, which is kind of a superposition of, appears as a superposition of P. So from the point of view of particle physics, the notion, the point X, which is building up the field, is a very quantum object that appears as a superposition of processes. Okay, so I hope, I know you learn that these two things are the same, but you know, it's nice to appreciate it too. So what string theory says is that it says, well, let's take these two principles. Okay, so string theory in some sense has two fundamental principles. One is the relativity principle, and the other one is that, okay, as much as quantum gravity. So quantum gravity, loop quantum gravity, is essentially you want to respect relativity, and you want to have a length scale. So you focus on that guy, right? You're trying, and that's where, you know, in the naive version, so there's quantum gravity. There are several layers of, I would say, loop-like quantum gravity. The one where people try to force feed more or less this quantum space-time. Like, you know, you could have a, so the most naive version, which I find very force-fed, but that's, you know, why you can learn from the noise to say, well, it's just a random lattice. Okay, it's fundamentally discrete. Okay. Then you have a causal set. It's also it's a set of points in the causal network. It's still classical and discrete. Or loop quantum gravity, it's more because the quantization comes from I find it more appealing and more interesting because the quantization really comes from quantum mechanics. Okay, but it really, all this quantization really focuses on relativity with a preferred length scale. Okay, but as I say, there's the other guy, which is G. Newton. And you can say, well, I have relativity plus a fundamental tension. Okay, M over L, which I call G, but you can call it alpha prime if you want. Okay, so string theory says, well, I'm going to, you know, so string theory is about having an extending object. What you're doing is that you're saying, well, I'm not extending. String theory is different. What you do is that you let go of the notion of space-time altogether, okay? And you focus just on the notion of probe, okay? If I look at a single particle, it doesn't contain any space-time. You can describe in terms of p, its phase space, its constraints, okay? The string is the same thing. You replace relativity with a fundamental tension, right? The fundamental tension appears in your action, which is the weight you put in the string is exponential 1 over 2 pi alpha prime, let's say in the free string, dx. Right, you have seen that action. Right, that's what replaces the fundamental particle. Okay, exponential 1 over I over h bar, integral of x dot square. Okay, so that's the generalization. In that, for a fundamental particle, all you need is an h bar. For the string, there's only one constant, there's no h bar. There's just an alpha prime, okay? Which is a fundamental tension. Okay, and personally, I'm interested in that because in some sense, this is the opposite thing, is that what is the physics with a non-zero length scale? This is kind of, it looks very loopy. What is the physics with a non-zero tension? And you know, string might be the universal answer to that, okay? But the perspective is different. You're not acting on space-time itself. You're acting on the probe, okay? And now the challenge you face, and this is the challenge that we have been undertaking in the past few years, is to say, okay, if you change the nature of the probe, what space-time do they live in? Okay, what type of quantum space-time, what type of generalization of quantum geometry does the fundamental string really lives in? Okay, so here the problem is that I have to undo a little bit what you have learned. So I think you have learned that the string lives in usual space-time. Is that, or?
Usual space-time, what do you mean?
What?
When you say usual space-time, what do you mean?
Like a manifold, differentiable, flat space, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, and I think this is the kind of things we have to do. So when people do that with the string, they don't really fully appreciate the revolution that the string is. Let's look. So let me try to explain a little bit. So there is. So you agree that the string. So one thing we understand very well about string theory, it's the way it was for, is the fact that string theory is about the sets of 2D conformal phi theory, right? This is what it is supposed to be about. Okay, you're studying the space of 2D conformal phi theory. The string field equations of motion are essentially that all the beta functions vanish. Okay, so there's a beautiful theorem which is due to the structure of to collections of people, but essentially it's due to Zamolodchikov that says that if you take a collection, and it's proven in 2D, in higher dimension, it's still a conjecture, but it says that if you study the space of all possible two-dimensional phi theories, all of them, you turn on all the couplings, you don't care how local, non-local they are, you just don't care. You want maybe some kind of local Lorentz invariance. And then you look at the sets of fixed points, Okay, these fixed points are going to be labeled by collections of a beta function vanishing, and then you can show that there's an action, a Zamolodchik of action, that essentially means that for every field, so you know, if you look at the space of phi theory, essentially you're going to have a set of coupling and a set of operators associated with it. Okay, and then you can show that these collections of beta functions, which could be humongous, is essentially there exists an action which consistently give all of them. Okay. And you know, ultimately the process of string theory is understand the property of data action. It's understand the property of 2D normalization flow. This is, it's a string theory as it was formulated in the 60s, in the 70s, formulated in the 90s, and unsolved. Okay, so when I say string theory, I mean string theory, that type of string theory. Of course, people sometimes say, okay, well, let's forget about it. Let's make it to string theory is about effective theory and it's supergravity and becomes duality. That's another version. It's string theory related, but that's not really the initial project. And then, you know, again, you can reformulate it as ADS-CFT. That's another interesting thing, but it's not what I call string theory. String theory is this fundamental project that says that what you're interested in is the study of this system. And you want to understand its geometry, and you understand what this action is. Now, the remarkable thing about string theory, here there's no notion of space-time, okay? I just have a collection of quantum system, and that's it. I just want to study the renormalization group flow of 2D quantum system. The remarkable thing about these things is that this action, the Zamolodchikov action, if you want, there seems to be come equipped with a certain notion of locality, and it seems to be equipped with a form of space-time, emergent space-time. So there's two pictures on string theory. You can either understand the sets of vertex operators. So let me give you, in the flat string, let me give you a typical vertex operator. A typical vertex operator would be, you know, exponential IP X of ZZ bar, right? Which, let's call it VP, okay? Which in the string, let's say the free string, you know, it's, this guy is a quantum operator. It splits into left and right mover. Okay, so this is it's a vertex operator like that, VPP. Okay, and then you want to understand. So there's a corresponding coupling constant, which is this G. There's a corresponding coupling constant. Let's call it phi p. Okay, which couples to this operator, and this coupling constant. So this is the magic of the string. You start from a set of vertex operator, okay? Then there's an associated coupling constant, which is labeled by the same quantum number. And this coupling constant, you're saying, oh, let me pretend that this coupling constant is the expansion, the Fourier expansion of some space-time field, okay? And then from that point of view, you can interpret this Zamolodchikov equation as an equation for space-time field. Okay, this is really kind of the magic trick that happens in string theory here. Okay, is that something you have seen? Does that resemble what? Oh, okay. So what have you have seen the concept of vertex operators? Have you seen how Einstein equation is derived from the beta function equation? No. Okay. Well, okay, because this is really, you can study string for different perspective. If you want to study string for quantum gravity, the first thing you want to show is how, by studying the beta function, of things, you recover something akin to Einstein equation. This was a big thing. So, let me give you an intuitive reason why I call it. It's really the fundamental idea of Friedan. I call it the quantum equivalence principle. So imagine now, you know, I'm saying I have a quantum object which is delocalized. It's a string, and let me assume I turn on a gravitational background. Okay, so suppose I don't put that string into flat space, but into a curved space. Okay, now, if you have a non-local object that propagates into a curved space, it's not going to, in general, follow geodesic, because there's going to be tidal effects. That guy is going to be pulled more than that guy, and then the thing is going to squish and deform and eventually deviate and have a specific acceleration proportional to the shape. Now you can demand something, which is, I hope you can appreciate how radical it is. You're saying, well, I don't want that. I don't want that. I don't want space-time to be able to tell that my string is a string or that my object is not local. I want my non-local object to follow a geodesic. I want that. Why? I have no idea. But let's say this is a new principle in physics, which is that you want that the minute, because what's going to happen is that the local quantum fluctuations are going to be enhanced, right? And you say, I don't want space-time or me to somehow space-time has to hide itself from, you know, hide the fundamental structure of itself. Okay, so you say you don't want that. You say you the short fluctuations should not affect the way the quantum object follows. And then from there, it's very easy to conclude. Well, no, it's not complicated. It's not complicated. It's, well, let me give you a very, you know, let me give you, okay. Suppose I look at two different points, okay? And they're separated like that. Let me give you like a baby version of why this principle, it doesn't make any sense. It's beautiful. It's you know, remember, the thing that you're taught to is that the universe tells the particle how to behave. Here, I'm saying, this is Friedan. He's crazy. He says, let's tell the particle how the universe should behave. That's really what string theory is about. Okay? That principle, I don't understand. I don't think anybody understands, but I appreciate it. I'm like, well, if that idea, this is for me a revolutionary idea. Okay, so how does it work? You say you want to look at the acceleration of that guy, xi dot dot. Essentially, you're going to get that this is r, you know, a, b, well, r a xi dot. Sorry, how does it work? So this is the delta xi dot. Okay, so you have a, you know, b u delta xi. Okay, so that's the deviation equation. Okay, and u is the velocity, right? So u is xi dot, which is like momentum. Okay, so now let's say, well, this is this operator. Let's say everything is quantum now or delocalized. So now you want to say, well, I want to take the average of that equation. Okay, so I'm getting an object which is r a b c d p b. You know. PD, some quantum operator here, which is fluctuating, which measures the momentum at different positions of my times delta xeb. And you say, well, I want that to be zero. And then you compute the average value of that guy. And because it's relativistic, the only thing it can be is that it's proportional to GPD. So demanding that it's zero implies that RAB equals zero. Okay? So this is essentially the mechanism by which demanding conformal invariance, that is demanding that the minute UV detail is invisible to the global motion of the string, implies the Einstein equation. Am I too, and I don't know if you, yeah. It would require me just a lecture to do it properly in the string theory, but if you have seen a CFT, this is, does that make sense? Okay. So, very good. So now, that thing intrigued me, okay? And this is why I wanted to, and it intrigued a lot of people back then, and then somehow it was forgotten, and people were just happy to treat string theory as an effectivity theory. Why string theory cannot be entirely described in terms of the language of effective theory is known for a long time. It goes back to a very beautiful work of Klebanov and Suskind. Okay, the first one is Friedan. Okay, the fact that somehow demanding conformal invariance, or demanding in some sense invisibility of small quantum fluctuation. Right, the conformally invariance is essentially the fact that the UV details are completely, you cannot see them. So this is really what it means, implying the Einstein equation. Okay, so that was the one thing that somehow convinced people, more than just the graviton scattering, that string theory might have to do with quantum gravity, because somehow you have a perspective where, you know, you could claim that you derive Einstein equation. And people did make that claim. I think it's a bit overkill, but anyway, you know, that in that sense. Okay, another thing that's very important is what target the string lives in. So let me challenge this idea that the target that the string lives in is really usual spacetime. It's not. And why is it not? Let me give you two evidence, which have been known for a long time. So nothing I'm saying here is new. It's known since the 70s, right? But as you will learn in physics, the way people make progress is that they know something, and it's too much. So then they ignore it. And the people who start ignoring, they know they ignore. But then the students that come after, they come, and they don't know that there's something being ignored. And they think this is the whole thing, right? And so, you know, you have to, I'm sorry for you, but you have to kind of, you know, that's the process of discovery. And then at every generation, and then, you know, you wait 30 years, and then it's rediscovered again, what was known before, right? So this is why you need old guys around like me, which have been through this up and down, and they don't believe anybody. So, you know, I understand, I appreciate the ability of making an hypothesis, but you know, it's also, in psychology, they do this experiment. If I repeat something wrong for long enough, right? Like, obviously wrong, they made these things in you know, campus, like in the very high-level campus, and I ask people how stupid is that statement. In the beginning, 99% say, well, you repeat it for 9 months, and you make the same poll, and you find 50 to 60% finds it's a good statement. Right? If you repeat something long enough, it becomes the truth. It's how we our brain works. But anyway, so it's not that it's wrong. It's like it's an hypothesis that was made. So why? Okay, the challenge about space-time. If you think about string theory, is about an action that depends on quantum fields. Okay, phi hat. These fields, okay, I can organize them in, let's say, a multiplate or things that resemble coordinates. If you want, that's fine. But these objects are quantum operators. Okay, they're not classical objects. They satisfy non-trivial commutation relations. Okay, so how do you go from this quantum object to a classical X here? Okay, so what you can try to do is, so Klebanov-Suskind, they say, well, let's try to understand what is the space-time of the string. The way you would understand that is how you would define any quantum theory is to first put the string on the lattice. So imagine that they did that in the light cone gauge. So, you know, instead of looking at a continuous string, you're saying, well, let me take a collection of string here. The word sheet distance would be epsilon, okay? I'm in light cone gauge, so that the number of time epsilon is essentially your gauge fix to be some kind of light cone momenta. Okay? And then you want to take the limit epsilon goes to zero, and therefore n to infinity. Okay? That sounds very natural. So this is your string. You have a sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3, etc. And then you ask a very natural question. You're saying, well, let me compute delta x I, which is x at sigma I plus 1 minus x at sigma I. Okay? And remember, sigma I plus 1 is sigma I plus epsilon. Okay? And then let me compute the expectation value of delta x squared. Okay, so that guy is a quantum operator, and I can compute the expectation value. Okay, and I want to know what is the limit of that expectation value when epsilon goes to zero. So naively, you would say, well, every point, you know, sigma I goes to sigma I plus one, so you should find what, zero, right? What do you find? Any idea?
Not zero.
Yeah, that's good. You find the string length. Remember, in the string, if you have h bar and fundamental tension, you have a length, and you find lambda square. So essentially, it's saying that when I take, and the reason you find non-zero is very simple. It's a conformality theory. Okay, so that system where I, the limit where I take these points, so the limit where, let's say, I fix the length of the string, and I take these points to be denser and denser, right, is absolutely equivalent because of conformal invariance. The limit where I decide that every distance between the string bits are one, and the length of the string goes to infinity. This is conformal invariance, right? The continuity limit of conformal invariance theory is radically, completely, utterly different from the continuum limit of theory with a mass gap. Okay, so you're taught to think about physics in terms of theory with a mass gap. Theory which are gapless, whoosh, they wipe everything out. And this is so the continuum limit of a CFT is fundamentally discrete. It is. Okay, which means that from the point of view of the string, this is a continuum limit. Every point on the string is a continuum, but the target is fundamentally discrete. Every two points have a minimum distance. Okay, so that's puzzling. Okay, and then you can go on and on, and then So anyway, you can go on and on and conclude that one single string has necessarily infinite length. House of dimension infinite. So all of these things was known before. So in some sense, one string fills the entire universe, which explains why the idea of freedom can work in some sense. The way you relate to the usual string, which is a string in a semi-classical space-time, is when you take that limit, but then you probe the string with very very specific type of states, right? So every time people talk to you about a limit, you have to be careful about what it means. So, you know, there's lots of modes in the string, and if you want to access the string bits, you have to excite lots of modes together in the string, and then they repackage themselves into this discrete geometry. But if you excite very few modes, then you can organize your string expansion in terms of things that looks like field propagating in space-time. Okay? But it's only, you know, it's only a very particular approximation. This is not what the string is fundamentally. Another example of why the string is so different is that even if you don't buy that and you don't want Klebanov and Suskind, I mean, Suskind is an interesting guy because the reason Suskind, I don't know if you know his work, but Suskind was one of the co-inventors of holography. He was one of the co-inventors of matrix model. He was one of the person in string theory that kept trying. He's very active in these bits recently. He's one of the person that keep trying understand what it is about. And it goes back to that. He knows that the string is not about space-time. It's about some deeper structure, which has some large n. Okay, so it explains why he has done all these weird things, because he knew. He did not forget. Okay, because he was the one that invented. So sometimes knowing, you know, you can go along the flow, but it helps you to, you know, jump. Another things where, what I was saying earlier is that I was saying, well, there's a natural. So the way you realize space-time is that you start from a. So the philosophy of the string is what? You start from a CFT. Okay, the CFT is a collection of operators. We saw some of these operators organize themselves into vertex operator, primary fields, that looks like they're labeled by a momenta. And this momenta you interpret as the momenta of an effective field. And then you can organize the different momenta, the conformal invariance conditions, as a collections of fields of different masses. Okay, that's the usual string. But if you look at the fundamental free string, and around the free, if you look at what is the space of CFT around the free string, it looks like you're recovering usual field theory. But it turns out that even in the free string case, so even that statement is not true. Okay. The statement that perturbations of CFT around free string is just usual space-time is not true. It's because you can, because the string has two modes, the left and right mode, and you can excite the string by momenta, but you can also excite the string by something which is called winding. Okay, and then the string equation. So if you have zero winding, the string equation is m squared, right? So, I don't know. I think you have seen this equation, right? The string has a left mover excitation, right mover excitation, and then there's an offset minus 2, and that's the mass. Okay? And if you have 0, you have the tachyon, and n equal 1, 1 is the graviton. It gets massless. But in general, that's not the most general excitation. If you play the game of freedom, you should take a free string and excite it by any operator you have, not pre-select the operator you want. You should put together the complete basis of operator in your theory. The complete basis of operator theory contains momentum and winding, and the equations are like that. Okay. So this is really the theory you want to understand. So already, if you look at the perturbation of the string, you realize, if you want usual field theory, you have to impose an extra condition, which is n equal n tilde, which is called level matching here, which kills essentially, which implies that p tilde equal to 0, okay, which realizes this space-time interpretation of excitation of the string. This is something you can do a posteriori because you want a space-time interpretation of what the string is. But if you ask what space-time does the string lives in, it does not necessarily live in the usual space-time. It lives in something which now is in some sense doubled. And it's this study of understanding this geometry has led to extremely interesting new mathematical geometry called generalized geometry. Oh, okay. And it's still in construction. So we are in the process of uncovering something which is the space-time of string here, but it's definitely not that guy. Something new, right? And understanding the geometrical property of this generalized geometry, it's also called the geometry of T-duality. Okay? So why do I say it's T-duality? Because the old way of understanding this geometry was to say, well, these things happen from the target, it's the usual target, but somehow some of the circles are compactified of length r. Okay? And then this symmetry between p and p tilde, this exchange, you can see there's a total perfect symmetry. Exchanging the right, left and right mover is a symmetry of the theory. It's called the target symmetry. Essentially amounts to sending r into 1 over r. Okay, so T-duality is this property that, okay. Now, why is that so interesting? That's so interesting because that violates one of the fundamental axioms of theoretical modern physics. What is the fundamental axiom of theoretical physics? Decoupling of scale. It's Wilson. Like, the life of bacteria doesn't depend on the life of galaxies. Well, if string theory is correct, they do. What does that mean? So this is really, so here what I'm meaning at is that a deeper project beyond quantum gravity, besides understanding what is X, is understanding in what sense, this is for, in what sense effectivity theory, or how effectivity theory is going to die, right? So if you think about it, effectivity, if you believe in effectivity, we have a theory of quantum gravity, it's wrapped up, we don't need anything more. Everything organizes itself in scale, and I can compute at any order in approximation any correction you like. It's over. Okay? So quantum gravity, the original picture, is not some kind of telling me what type of effectivity theory I should do. Quantum gravity, for me, is a fundamental revolution, even deeper than quantum mechanics, which one of its elements is that if you bring together a fundamental length scale and a fundamental tension scale, it leads to some form of UV infrared duality, which essentially means a breaking of effectivity. Okay, so we learned something from string theory in quantum gravity.